Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The year 2019 marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing on July 20, 1969. Photography played a significant role both in preparing for the mission and in shaping the cultural consciousness of the event. By the Light of the Silvery Moon, A Century of Lunar Photographs features works ranging in date from the 19th century to the Space Age 1960s. The event, Photographing the Moon, held on October 3, 2019 at the National Gallery of Art, celebrated this exhibition by inviting three curators from the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum to give talks on the intertwined histories of photography and space exploration. In the third talk, Jennifer Levasseur looked at photographs taken in space by people, revealing the ways that images captured the astronauts of the Apollo era have formed the framework for our understanding of human spaceflight today.
Well, thank you both, David and Matt, for really laying the groundwork for what I'll talk about today, which is we've looked through telescopes, we've looked through robots, now we're going to look through the eyes of the astronauts themselves. And it was 50 years ago, of course, that humans made footprints on the moon for the first time. And then that footprint's still there today, thanks to there not being an atmosphere. And so, of course, if we made footprints on the moon, we were going to need to take pictures of them. And the person that took this created, obviously, a moment that was significant in terms of achievement, but also it sort of transitioned now into something that's symbolic and iconic and evidence for all time that we, in fact, did do this thing, this amazing thing. And thanks to the digital technologies of today and the internet and social media and websites that allow you to look through these catalogs of images, it spreads around the world. And so knowledge of our journeys to the moon can travel quite easily. We don't require newspapers anymore. We can do it via the internet. And so these photographs, more than even the rocks or the stories from the astronauts or movies that we might see on Netflix, have the ability to live on in our shared memory of a time that some of us don't even remember personally, and I'm one of those, certainly. I've wondered what makes an image like this and others that I'm going to show you mean so much to people. And so I'm going to look at this a little bit more from our own perspective, but because of the presence of the astronauts. What makes us feel proud of landing on the moon? Why do we use them pretty much anywhere you can think of? You can even buy a sweatshirt now that looks like Neil Armstrong's spacesuit. But these appear all over the place. Why have we done that with images that really had a different purpose? As Matt indicated, and certainly as David did as well, images of the moon, from whatever perspective, are usually in the service of science, and in this case, the service of geologists in particular. So what was it that brought us to this point of looking at the moon through the eyes of the astronauts? And I'm going to backtrack just a little bit to before we got to the moon and what we were sort of expecting by that time in the late 1960s when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin stepped on the moon. Our initial views from astronauts through the cameras and through their eyes were spectacular. These weren't things that we hadn't necessarily seen before, but we hadn't seen them from the perspective of a human holding a camera, something we could all identify with. And so this is an image of our atmosphere, what's called the airglow layer, during John Glenn's Mercury mission in 1962. And it just kind of gave us reason to want more. It's spectacular. We were able to obviously put ourselves in the shoes or in the spacesuits of the astronauts to think about what they were seeing as opposed to trying to imagine what it might be like to be on a spacecraft that's just robotically controlled. So 3 years later, we moved on to something that's even more spectacular. We got to see actual human beings in space. Project Gemini, this is the first spacewalk by an American, Ed White, in July of 1965. And we can see exactly what it looks like to be in space, to live and potentially work there. It's put on TV. It's on magazine covers, newspapers. These are things that are becoming sort of publicly consumed in a really broad way. And we can, of course, because we can see a person there, it's an identifiable shape, we can imagine ourselves being that person. we know that they are in space. It's not just from the backside of the camera anymore. We can see the people actually carrying out activities in space. But these were, if nothing else, proof that we were actually doing this, that maybe taxpayer dollars had actually gone to something useful. But it provided what kind of is the reverse of what I'll go on to talk about. It's also the beginnings of something called the overview effect, which is a phrase that kind of comes up much later than the Apollo program or the Gemini program even, but it's the way of seeing Earth as opposed to seeing the moon that sort of reshapes our vision of what it is to go into space. It's looking back and seeing the Earth as fragile, not looking at the moon and imagining what it might be like to go there. But we do go there. We go there on Apollo 8, as Matt mentioned. We have the Earthrise image that's captured in late 1968 by the Apollo 8 astronauts. It's a game changer. It's seen on television first during the crew's famous Christmas Eve broadcast, but that was black and white. It was kind of fuzzy, and it's a long ways from the moon, so you're not necessarily going to get the high quality that you would out of a photograph. And so Frank Borman and Jim Lovell and Bill Anders were seeing this site, and I think this photograph obviously really expresses exactly the words that they used, that Bill Anders in particular used, was, wow, look at that view. And so it is a spectacular, sublime view that they're seeing, but it's also giving some real life words to the things that had already been seen by those robotic vehicles just a few years before. And some of you are probably, most of you are probably wondering why this image is tilted the way it is in portrait view. And that's because this is the way the photographer actually intended it to be seen. And we talked a little bit about this before we started today. There's no up or down in space. So it's all about how you perceive your orientation to other objects. We're familiar with landscape views because we stand on the Earth. But Bill Anders wasn't standing on the moon, and neither were any of the astronauts in the spacecraft. But the way that Bill Anders intended people to see the view of Earth was as the spacecraft was going around the equator. They orbited at the equator as well. And when he looked out the window, this is the view that he saw. And so that's his interpretation of the view. Frank Borman did see it as a landscape. That's the way he was pointed when he took his picture. And so if you saw the black and white version that Frank Borman took, you would see it in landscape. But for the most part, we usually see it in landscape, and that's because that's what we're familiar with. So based on our own human experience, we have expectations for images of spaceflight. It's the ones, they don't always obviously fit our expectations, though. We've shaped that by our personal experience, but also by the experience of other explorers, people who went around on the Earth and saw similar sights as what the astronauts would see. And so my argument is basically that there's a set of expectations going into Apollo, not only in terms of science, but also in terms of just the general exploration of the moon that has already created a set of understandings of what we'll see once we finally get there. And that's based on, as I said, exploration of Earth. And so there are these other exploration efforts throughout our history that sort of set up this visual rhetoric that you then see carried out by the Apollo astronauts as well. You've got certain themes that arise across all of these efforts. You see the horizon. And so when geologists are carrying out their expeditions in the American West, they want to show these long-distance views of the horizon. And likewise, during exploration of the Antarctic, photographers are out there taking these same kinds of views of the distance. And of course, during the Apollo missions, we're seeing Earth in the distance. And it leads you to wonder, begs the questions. You as a viewer are, you're curious about what the foreground holds and what just might be over that horizon. Another theme is sort of the theme of accomplishment. There are people in these images. That's what makes them distinctly unique from those robotic images. You could actually put a person in these views. And so you have views when people have come across something that they've never seen before that's particularly exciting. In the case of the expeditions to the Antarctic up there on the upper right, they're excited that they might be rescued. This is during the Shackleton's trip, and that was one of the boats kind of going off to rescue, to go off for rescue. And so these guys are not necessarily excited to see the boat. They're seeing the boat off and giving a lot of, obviously, signals of hope. But then for the Apollo missions, we have countless images of celebration, and sometimes that takes on a particularly nationalistic tone, but people around the world are celebrating these because they're seeing people in these locations that we would never have seen otherwise, or we would never have seen through their eyes without these types of images. And so we can celebrate along with them. But it's also important to understand how we got there. The moon is an unfamiliar place, just as some locations in the American West or Antarctica itself are sometimes still unfamiliar to many of us if we haven't traveled there ourselves. So you have to have some sense of how people got there, no matter how foreign or familiar those methods of transportation might be. And so we see boats, we see large ships in the background of images. And in the case, of course, of Apollo, we see the lunar module or we see the lunar rover. We see the methods of transportation that are important to connecting the human to the location. But again, the human becomes a really important part of understanding the landscape. You're not just seeing from the robotic perspective of an orbiter or through the eyes of that elevated camera on a surveyor lander what it looks like around that particular location. You can get a sense of the location even better if you can see a person up next to some of those features. And so you've got someone standing on top of a glacier, or you've got someone standing next to a large ice formation in the Antarctic, or you have an astronaut standing next to a gigantic boulder. That really gives a sense of just what these kinds of landscapes offered us in terms of research. But it also gives us a hint, especially in this case, of the kinds of things we might begin to see when we go to another location, if humans are to go. And this is a question, of course, we tackle at the museum all the time, because young people in particular want to know what comes next. It's not just about what's happening today, it's about what comes next. And with promises of going back to the moon or to Mars, we can expect more of this. It will be similar, and you can see that already in some of the images that have come from our robotic explorers on Mars. We're looking to see some of these similar themes play out in each of those. So we have our robotic friends who have traveled around on Mars, and we even see their own portraits taken from cameras that can be elevated from quite a distance up. But what are the things that we used to take these photographs on the moon? So we need a really great camera. And the Apollo astronauts had a number of cameras. They did create stereoscopic views using a Kodak camera that actually Eugene Shoemaker, I believe, was involved in creating. But Kodak created that camera to take those stereoscopic views. But for the images that we knew we were expecting, that NASA expected, but also that scientists would expect, and from this point of view, you needed something that was easy to operate, something that could be familiar and would be very flexible and easily managed inside a massive spacesuit that would have to be worn to protect the astronauts. So they use something that's basically off the shelf but modified for astronauts to some degree, and they select a Hasselblad camera, which is what you see here. This is the Hasselblad camera used by, not on the surface of the moon, but it was used by Michael Collins and the astronauts in the command module during the Apollo 11 mission. And you can see there are some accommodations made for the fact that astronauts have to wear spacesuits. It has a little tab down here that's been added to the lens to be able to change the position. It's got some Velcro in case they need to stick it up against the wall. And there's some other slight modifications and some, of course, little pro tips on little settings and things that they could do. The astronauts trained considerably for these missions, but they did have to have lots of backup mechanisms just in case they forgot exactly what they were supposed to do. So the modifications that you can't see include things like films. David mentioned films and having special emulsions and things made. So, of course, NASA reached out to companies that would know how to do those things and do them well. So they wanted to fit as many frames in there as they could. And so these magazines traditionally would have had about 70 frames on a roll of film. These ones were able to accommodate 200. And so by using a very thin film, they were able to obviously put more frames on there. Kodak was heavily involved in that process. They also modified the shutter so that there were it had special lubricants on it that wouldn't be affected by the different kinds of atmospheres the astronauts would be encountering inside the spacecraft and later outside the spacecraft. And they wanted to remove as much weight or glass. Glass is a pretty bad thing to have break in space. It would get all over the place and create quite a bit of damage. So there's no viewfinder. The viewfinder would have been very heavy, but it also contained more glass. There's no mirror inside this camera. So they're really trying to streamline exactly what they're going to use in space. And typically, these don't come back. These are the ones that are inside the command modules, so they're a lot more, it's easier to bring them back. The ones that go to the moon that you often see in the photographs are painted silver or made with silver metals. Those most often stayed on the moon, though some of them did return. So what does return from the surface of the moon, especially during Apollo 11, are lots of magazines. Here we have the magazines that are in the museum's collection, and I think one of these is on display right now over in the museum. These are the magazines from Apollo 11 that returned, magazines R and S. And you can actually go online and find out what actually just came off of those magazines, what they were particularly used for, what photographs. But 142, over the course of the Apollo program, 142 of these Hasselblad magazines returned, which accounts for just over 18,000 photographic frames. The highest number being accumulated during the Apollo 17 mission, the last mission to the moon, and the least, just 5 magazines coming from the Apollo 13 mission, which I think is probably not a huge surprise if you know the Apollo 13 story. And so they come with these pre-printed labels, really giving the astronauts all the instructions they could possibly need when they're using this magazine and how to prepare the cameras. It's a great little cheat sheet for them to be able to do this. And they have all these imprinted guides in their mission manuals as well. All of the documentation that they're carrying with them. And so they bring back images, though, of things that we had never seen before. We see people on the moon. We see, of course, in this image, something that has really transcended all different places in all different applications. Some of the things I like to talk about when I see this image are the ways it becomes what we think of today as viral, because this image in particular has had quite a life of its own after it was returned from the moon in 1969. It becomes inspiration for artists. Andy Warhol has a very famous take on this photograph. But this is also then becomes a bit of fodder for other types of media outlets who want to consider themselves Apollo-like or astronaut-like or revolutionary, something that really makes something that kind of speeds up something to a level that we've never seen before. And in particular, the TV channel MTV took this image on, and many of the Apollo images and later shuttle imagery, as a sort of way to express their own sea change, what role they play in culture is sort of shaped the same way as the Apollo images sort of changed the way we look at something. And so up until recent years even, this image was the inspiration for their statuette that they would give away for one of their awards. And one of them even flew, and kind of completing the circle of this story, one of those statuettes eventually went to space, to the space station Mir in 1996. And so these are some of the visual cues that my generation in particular, and I think generations that follow mine, are going to have for understanding Apollo images and understanding what it meant to take pictures on the moon, is that these things, there are ways that they can connect to these moments and to these images that they're not necessarily expecting. But I want to look at one image in particular in some detail. And David brought up the idea of images as evidence. And this is one that I like to use particularly because it is a very close view. It is captured with a Hasselblad camera. It's not a stereoscopic image. It is one that you can look at and understand what is the utility of putting a person on the surface of the moon and what are the things that we could learn from the image itself. And so one of the things that didn't exist, as Matt brought up, that didn't exist for those lunar orbiter images, was some way for geologists to be able to measure distance. And so that's one major feature of Apollo images, is the addition to the magazines of a Rousseau plate, which allows them to then mark out exactly what are these distances. So photogrammetry becomes something that's much easier with these Apollo images, these astronaut images. They become incredibly useful to understanding the surface. You can also interpret from these images a great deal of the scientific information that isn't expressed necessarily in the samples that are returned from the mission. So you can understand the actual texture of the moon and the way in which the lunar regolith is sort of how it actually adheres to itself or create, you know, sort of creates this, or it's interacted with. So the story of this particular image, it's an image as part of a sequence that Buzz Aldrin took while he had the Hasselblad camera in his possession. Armstrong was actually the primary photographer for the mission. One of the reasons that you don't see images of him is he was mostly the photographer for the mission. But Aldrin had the camera, and I happened to ask him about this recently, about this particular image, because I have used it so many times. And what he explained to me is that he took a series of images because he wanted to get a very clean, pristine view of what his boot print was doing on the lunar surface, because he had noticed this and he wanted to actually show it in a very clean way. And there's another image I'll show you in a second that shows this is part of a sequence. So what you can tell from this is just what the consistency of the material is. You can also tell the sun angle. So he's pointed, the sun is over his shoulder. I noticed in one of the books outside that this image was actually flipped upside down, which would be quite impossible to take the image from that view, because you wouldn't be able to move your boot, you wouldn't be able to pull your leg out in that direction. It just doesn't work. So his description of how this image came about is that to get this pristine view, he had to find a spot that had been untouched, and then he had to actually put his foot down and lean backwards in order to not drag his boot out of that spot. And so that's why there is this great big shadow at the bottom, because the indentation of his boot was quite a bit greater at the backside where his heel was as he kind of pushed himself out of that spot. So it tells, you know, we have these multiple layers of information to be able to understand exactly how these images came about and what they can tell us and what the astronauts were really trying to tell us during their experiences on the moon. And here's one of those early versions of what he was trying to do. He's showing that, you know, obviously he's creating these boot prints. And there's lots of symbolism that one could read into any of these as well. But you can also tell there's quite a big difference between seeing an image that's color corrected and not color corrected. So this one is. They're also, I should say, using black and white black and white film as well, which gives even a greater contrast. So those are even incredibly more valuable. This might be more valuable to scientists than some of those color images. But this isn't the only way that people remember seeing the moon. And so seeing the moon comes in a couple different ways. And one of the ways that is often related and often spoke of more than the photographs is the live television broadcast. And this is the camera that was created by, this is a camera, a version of the camera created to capture those first views of the moon and send them back to Earth. And so this is obviously a huge part of sort of our narrative of the late 1960s, and something that came up in obviously for us over the summer in relating the story of the Apollo 11 landing. But it's also not easy to replicate these. You can broadcast, but reproducing them and viewing them again and again. And I think this is something that's often lost on a lot of our younger visitors to the museum, is in 1969, it wasn't possible to go to YouTube and just replay the whole thing over again. We didn't have those kinds of mechanisms to just, you didn't even have VCRs back then to be able to replay that recording. And so to see it once was one thing, and it imprints on your memory maybe, but it's not something that you can repetitively encounter. And so those photographs become really the best way to kind of re-encounter those moments over and over. Here's the camera as it was on the spacecraft. They had to stow it this way in order to make it all work. It then was flipped down through a lanyard system by Armstrong as he got down the ladder. And so then NASA had to kind of reverse engineer all that back on Earth. The signal came back to Earth through a very long route through satellites in Australia and receiving stations. And so it's kind of a long, winding road to the television in your home. And NASA then, of course, had to flip that image back over too, because the camera's pointed up, so it's kind of upside down, obviously. But about 500 million people watched that live broadcast, which is about 7% of the world's population at the time. And that's a high percentage of the U.S. viewers were tuned in, of course, of 125 million viewers. There's about 53 of 125 million people in the U.S. that there's about 53 million households that are watching this. So it's viewed obviously quite widely. And what do they see? They see this image. It's fairly fuzzy. There's lots of, as Matt was explaining with some of the television, the way that the images are sent from lunar orbiter, you've got the same kinds of issues, same kind of technique that you've got the camera, the television camera sending the signal, but you've got a long ways to travel. You've got issues of routing that signal back to Earth and back to someone's television. And so the quality of the signal is fairly low. And there, like there have been with the lunar orbiter images, been lots of efforts to redigitize some of this material. There's been searches over the years for the best quality tapes of that particular moment and how could we improve upon how we see the first steps. And so there's lots of techniques that have been tried. And it's gotten significantly better from what people probably saw on television in July of 1969. But how we see spaceflight today, since Apollo, is different. And even in my childhood, during the space shuttle era, you could simply turn on CNN and watch a launch. But that doesn't really happen today. Did anyone even know there was a landing today in Kazakhstan of some astronauts? So if you follow the space program, you might know that it happened. But otherwise, it's kind of invisible to most of us. But it's certainly not stopped or slowed down. It's only accelerated the way in which astronauts use photography to carry out their mission. There are lots of scientific photographic studies happening from the space station today. And you can actually kind of compile some of those themes I showed earlier into a single image. So here you can see the spacecraft, and sometimes you might see people in this image. You can see the Earth's horizon. You can see, you know, you can imagine how people got there. And so a lot of these themes are kind of, you know, layered on each other in a way that we haven't seen before. And you can share these much easier. Astronauts are sharing these images on social media, and so they're circulating in a much more free way than they would have previously. But we can take these, and we can take these Apollo images now that they're available online and share them and circulate them and really turn them into something much different, I think, than they were originally intended. I mentioned earlier that there were about 18,000 images taken by Apollo astronauts. There are tens of thousands of images coming down from the space station each week. It's so great that there are not enough people to catalog them on the ground. They go into servers in the Southwest and then into Houston, and there are just not nearly enough people to catalog each individual photograph. And so it's exponentially higher, but we still are seeing the same kinds of things. And we'll, of course, be able to continue as long as the space station is orbiting, continue to study Earth from a visual perspective, from the astronaut perspective, with some of the views that they're looking for. And scientists can go and request new photography of particular locations. Geologists can ask for that and get these kinds of returns where you have really high detail. You can study and of course, this is all available over the course of time. You can actually go into databases and look for images of exact geographic locations and view them over time. But you can imagine that this view is obviously quite a bit different than if it was, we understand this image in a much different way than we would understand it if it's taken by a robot. Google Earth does a similar, you know, obviously we could view something similarly, but that's not taken by an astronaut. So it makes something like this feel much different, which is home. You can see these things down to almost the street level. And this image from just a few years ago, which happened just to be the best image I could get of the Washington, D.C. area online a few days ago, shows that we're seeing ourselves in a new way. We're able to look at almost a street-level view of what it is we know every day. And so instead of looking at the moon, the space program in particular, in relation to the astronauts, is looking home. We're looking, six people are orbiting right now at about 250 miles up. And I think there is something certainly that changes our perspective when we know that there is an actual person behind the camera. And that changes certainly how we view and have viewed the moon, but also ourselves as we still stand on planet Earth. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.